Hello, everyone, and welcome again to the next episode of Kidney Compass, your guide to navigating the latest developments in kidney disease clinical trials. In this podcast, we're exploring the latest in clinical trials from therapeutic advances to new methodological approaches in trial design and analysis. And we're really excited today to be focusing on one new methodological aspect of clinical trials and new endpoints, and that is the use of hierarchical composite endpoints. Hello, Shika, and Happy New Year. Great to see you.
You too, Brendan. It's great to be back in 2025, and I'm super excited about our speakers today.
Yes, really excited to have Dustin and Niels here. And I'll allow Dustin and Niels to introduce themselves to the audience. They are experts not only in nephrology, but also new methods to analyze treatment effects for clinical trials, which we're going to be talking about today. Dustin, hey, how are you?
Hey, doing great, Brendan, and nice to be with you, Shika. Nice to be on the Kidney Compass here. So my name is Dustin Little. I'm a nephrologist based in the U.S., and I work in late-stage development, designing kidney disease clinical trials and helping to run them. And so I think I have about the best job in the world, and kidney endpoints is something I think about every single day. And I'm really happy to share the HCE, as we call it, and talk about that with you guys.
Awesome. We're excited you're here.
My name is Niels Jongs. I'm a statistician from the Netherlands, Groningen. That's all the way up the north. I think I've been a statistician in clinical trials for over 9 to 10 years, I think. I did my PhD in the development of new endpoints for psychiatric clinical trials. Later on, I ended up with Hitto. I think you all know Hitto. And now I'm doing the development of novel endpoints in CKD. And that's also how I got involved in these HEEs, the Hierarchical Composite Endpoints. So more than happy to talk about it, because I think it's going to be important for you guys.
Yeah, and I'm always trying to get both of you out to Sydney, Australia, but in the absence of that, and you too, Shuk, actually, but until then, this is probably the best we can do. So I'm really excited to have all of you here on the podcast today.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a good place maybe to start is when we're thinking about clinical trials, especially in nephrology, I think most people are used to, you know, traditional endpoints or composite endpoints and haven't necessarily heard of or had much experience with HCE. So could you maybe just set the stage for us by giving us maybe an example of, you know, traditional endpoints and composite endpoints that have been used in nephrology trials that a lot of our listeners are, you know, accustomed to, and then maybe touching a little bit on what are the limitations of those trials, those trial endpoints rather.
Yeah. So Niels, I'll start. So we're here to talk about HCEs, and you're right, Shika, the C is composite, and everybody, you're all used to composite endpoints. I mean, this is what we usually use with our clinical trials. So a typical composite endpoint might be time to cardiovascular death, first event of cardiovascular death, kidney failure, GFR less than 15, or a sustained decline in GFR of at least 50%. And, you know, we're really used to this. It's analyzed by hazard ratio, and Niels can tell us about that. We think we know what a hazard ratio means, but we can talk about, you know, the extent to which that's really true. But anyways, I think there really are some limitations to these composite endpoints. And the first one that I would point out is that the efficacy result is really driven by a pretty small proportion of the participants in the trial, those who progress toward an endpoint. And I'm glad, of course, that not very many people are progressing to that endpoint. But there's something about how, if there was a more efficient way to make sure that every patient who participates in a clinical trial really contributes not only to the safety and the time at risk, but also the efficacy assessment. So that's, I think, one limitation. And the other one that I would point out is that the event that counts for people in a trial design like that is the first event that happens. And it's not necessarily true that a 50% decline in GFR, although that's you know, a pretty serious thing, that is of the same clinical relevance as a cardiovascular death. And so I think those two things, right, the results are driven by the really rapid progressors, maybe that's 10, 15% of the trial population, and there's no prioritization of events based on the clinical significance, I think, are a couple of the real limitations that got us thinking about things like the HCE. Niels, do you have anything like from a stats standpoint to add to the limitations?
No, I think this is perfectly how you summarize it. I think we can discuss the limitations of a hazard ratio, but let's not go into that detail because that's going to get complicated really quick. But it's good to keep in mind that of course, I think you guys visited Washington last week. There was this entire discussion about the HCEs and that the limitations, I think, that hold for these HCEs also hold for the win ratio, many of them at least, I think, right? Sure, that's what I wanted to mention, but yeah.
You know, guy, Shika, if I may, I just want to say another hat I wear, and it's maybe a half day a week, is I volunteer at a CKD clinic in the area, and there's something about kidney disease where, you know, I don't only want to treat the people that have a risk of developing kidney failure in the next 2 years. I want to intervene earlier, right? I want to slow down or, you know, in a perfect world, halt the progression of their CKD so they can live longer, so they can never have to worry about dialysis, so they don't have complications of their CKD. And something doesn't always match when we're designing a trial and we're so focused on just comparing, you know, who develops kidney failure or not. I'm also very interested in what happens to the people who are a little bit earlier in their disease course, who have an unacceptable lifetime risk of progressing to kidney failure, but who in a 2 or 3 year clinical trial horizon aren't likely to contribute an event like that.
So I think you guys brought up some really great points here. And just, I want you to tell me if I'm thinking of this correctly. So one of the big issues is when we have a composite endpoint, all of the different factors are sort of given equal weight when in reality, death is much more significant than, say, a 40% decline in GFR, 50%, 57%, which of course is predictive of long-term end-stage kidney disease. And we know that's a validated surrogate. However, if we had to look at those individual components, certain ones certainly have more significance. Yet when we're doing a composite endpoint, they're all weighted a bit equally, and that is not necessarily clinically meaningful. And then the other piece I think that you brought up is, you know, because of the way clinical trials are conducted, due to whether that's a sample size, it's the duration of the trial, most of the patients aren't going to hit that clinical endpoint. And they're not included then into, you know, a time to event analysis. So it sounds like these are some of the issues that we have with traditional composite endpoints. And, you know, maybe at some point we can also talk about sample size. As Brendan knows, I am in the rare kidney disease space. So I focus a lot on glomerular disease, where we have the added challenge of we have such few patients with these diseases, and we really have to try and, you know, design trials to identify those most at-risk patients to ensure that we're hitting enough events. But the majority of patients aren't going to hit that clinical event. So am I thinking about this correctly? And Brendan, do you want to chime in?
Yeah, I think that's a perfect summary, Shika. And, you know, again, just to pick up on that point that Dustin mentioned about the first event counting. So just so we're clear, Dustin, and for our listeners, if you have a patient who experiences a 50% decline in GFR and then develops kidney failure, in a traditional composite endpoint, what counts is the 50% decline in GFR. Is that right? And the kidney failure doesn't actually contribute towards the treatment effect. Am I right, Zach?
It's ignored. It's ignored, right? But at this point.
Ignored, yeah.
So it can be. Yeah.
Okay, so that's really important to understand. So building upon that, Niels, what can you explain to us what a nephrology or a kidney hierarchical composite endpoint is? What does it look like, and how does it address these limitations?
Well, I think the components do not differ that much from a traditional endpoint. It still holds at least the kidney composite that we introduced. Death dialysis, EGFR decline, those kind of endpoints, the hard clinical endpoints, how they call them, I think. But correct me if I'm wrong. But to make sure that every patient contributes to the analysis, we also added EGFR slope. So if a patient didn't experience an event, so he didn't experience, he did not need dialysis, or he didn't die, or he didn't have an EGFR drop of 50%, we analyze his EGFR slope over the trial. So that basically means that his or her EGFR decline during the trial is taken into account.
That's really helpful. And so, Dustin, you know, with a renal hierarchical composite endpoint that includes death, dialysis, sustained GFR less than 15, 57% decline in GFR, 50% decline in GFR, 40% decline in GFR, GFR slope. How do we put all of those components together, and how is it analyzed through what methods? We talked about a hazards ratio, but is it the hazards ratio, or is it a different a measure of treatment effect?
So Brendan, if I actually want to back up for a second, and one of the things you know about me, and you'll learn about me too, Shika, is I always try to bring, I like music, so I always try to bring it to music. And I think of, we used an analogy at another meeting of the kidney HCE as a super group. So my dad used to always tell me about classic rock, and he would tell me about how Eric Clapton was in this band with these other guys, and they were called Cream, and they were a super group. And that's what I think of the HCE as. It's a super group. It's a combination of the hard clinical endpoints that we talked about and GFR slope, right? And the thing about it is, you know, your listeners to this podcast, they're all going to be, you know, kidney clinical trial nerds like the rest of us. And so they're going to be used to GFR slope. And they're going to know that we're so lucky in CKD to have this wonderful surrogate endpoint, right, of GFR slope. If we study enough people and we see that the GFR is flatter over time in the treatment than the people in the control, we know we've got a good drug on our hands that's going to prevent kidney events. But the challenge there, right, is that in that trial design, and bear with me for a second, it gets a little wonky, at least when I think about it. If someone dies, unfortunately, or if they start dialysis, something really important has happened to them, right, clinically. But in the analysis, Niels has to do something to, Niels has to say, well, they've died, so I can't look at their GFR, or they've started dialysis, so I can't appropriately estimate their GFR. And he has to, account for missing data or something like this. And with the hierarchical composite endpoint, and this is how I'm rounding back to your question, Brendan, is we can, when that happens, we can say that's the event that, you know, that we're going to use in this analysis. And with the way these are put together, we don't prioritize events by what happened first. And we talked about how that's how we do it with typical composites. We put them in a clinical hierarchy. And we say, what's the most clinically important event? Was there a death? And then we go down. Then we go down that list. And so it really is a combination. Like my one-liner for what this is a combination of our typical clinical events and GFR slope. And you know, maybe Niels can talk a little bit about what the method is. But I just wanted your listeners to kind of understand, you know, that's you know, sort of the what we've been able to do with the HC is combine those two types of endpoints.
Yeah, so the methods, I think they're very elegant from a statistical perspective. There's something what we call non-parametric. So they're not sensitive to all the assumptions we have in those statistics we used to use, let's put it that way. And they're basically analyzed in a generalized pairwise comparison fashion. And this is maybe a very technical thing, but imagine you have two patients in the active arm and two patients in the placebo arm, and you basically compare every patient in the active arm against every patient in the placebo arm. That means that if you have one patient in the active arm, you compare it two times with a patient in the placebo arm, and you do the same thing for the second patient. So you get 2 times 2 comparisons. And you're able to determine how often a patient in the active arm is doing better than the patient in the placebo arm. And then you go back to simple probability calculations, and we calculate something that's called the win odds, which basically describes the odds of the active arm doing better than a placebo arm. I have to say this is an overly simplistic explanation, and well, maybe there are some issues out there, but that is the simple explanation of this method, basically.
So
yeah, go ahead, friend.
To build on that example, and maybe Shika, you might be asking this too, but is this right in saying that if you have, let's say you're comparing two patients, one in the active and one in placebo, you would go down the hierarchy of importance, clinical importance of outcome, right? So if you have two patients, neither of them have died, they're both alive at the end of the trial. So you discount that, you have on the X one. So you look at dialysis and both of them and not on dialysis. So you keep moving down. Neither of them have a sustained decline in GFR of to less than 15, keep going down. But one of them has experienced a 40% decline in GFR, and that person, and the other person is then, you know, the winner. So the person who does better, and the comparison is in the end, the estimation of the treatment effect is the arm of the trial that has more people doing better than the other arm. Would that be fair to say?
Exactly, exactly. And also imagine that if both patients died, for example, we look at which patient died first. And then the patient that died first is the loser, of course. I'm not sure if loser is the right word here, but that's how we use it in the terms right now. And then if none of the patients experienced the event, we compare the eGFR slope. And then, you know, the patient with the steeper slope is, well, again, sorry for my wording, but the loser.
Mm-hmm. And Brendan, you asked about, I mean, that's exactly right. And like Niels told you, is we just do the number of wins for the active group, and we divide it by the number of wins for the control group, and then that's the win odds. And so if we do 25 comparisons and there's 15 wins in the active group and 10 wins in the control group, that's a win odds. Even I can calculate that at 1.5, right? And you know, you asked about hazard ratio, and the first thing that becomes obvious when we think about this, right, is that a hazard ratio of less than one is good, right? So if our confidence interval is all less than one, you know, we've got a treatment benefit statistically. But it's sort of flipped with the win odds, right? We want more wins on the treatment than the control, so a win odds of greater than one is where we're seeing a benefit. So if our confidence interval is all greater than one, you know, we've seen a benefit there. So that's the first part you got to think about when interpreting those results. You got to get your mind a little bit out of the hazard ratio piece and then think about the win odds. And we all know that, you know, more wins is better. So it makes sense that it would be greater than one is the goal.
So I think this is really important. And I think there's, you know, you guys have two really great JASN papers that address these. There's one that shows you, you know, patient A versus patient B, exactly doing this comparison of who wins based on, do they get end-stage kidney disease? They both get end-stage kidney disease, but one got it earlier. So the one that got it earlier lost, the one who got it later won. So definitely encourage our listeners to check those out, and we can link those. But I think this other point about the hazard ratios is really helpful, because you guys have done a study that was recently published looking at post-hoc analyses of multiple trials, and you looked at how their hazard ratios compared to their win odds ratio. And it seems like they do, you know, they really are in the opposite direction, but they seem to be telling you the exact story we want them to be telling, if I understand that correctly.
Yeah, that's right, Shika. We, you know, we had the pleasure of, you know, working with several colleagues, Ohito, like you mentioned, Brendan, and Micah Brinker and Patrick Schlomer from Bayer and others. And we looked at, it was seven trials, and, you know, trials everybody knows, even some of the old hits from the past, like Renal and ID&T, but also some of the newer Sonar, Credence, DAPA-CKD, Fidelio, and exactly like you said. So Niels did these wonderful analyses, and he looked at what was the treatment effect on GFR slope. We reported, you know, what was the treatment effect on the primary endpoint, which was hazard ratio in every case. And then we said, what was the treatment effect on the win odds with the hierarchical composite. And just like you're describing, we saw really good consistency through all of those. And we had a little a little figure that Niels came up with that plotted out the, you know, the win odds on one axis and the hazard ratio on the other axis. And we really did see quite a bit of consistency. So we were encouraged by that.
I think sometimes people say that the hazard ratio is just the inverse, the win odds is the inverse of the hazard ratio. But that is something, of course, we have to debunk, right, Dustin? I think that is not the case. And so they align very strongly, but in the opposite direction. But we have to remember that the endpoints are slightly different. So there's always a very minor difference because we incorporate eGFR slope while the original trials, they didn't do it, right? So they only looked at the hard clinical endpoints. So they never can be the same, but they align very strongly.
And Niels, a great thing about that paper that Chika referenced that you guys wrote is that you not only looked at trials where there was a clear positive benefit, but you took trials that had no or benefit or harm. And that a good example was Altitude. And in Altitude, you saw the exact opposite. You see harm with the hazards ratio and harm with the win odds. So it's the win odds was lower. Is that correct?
Was it harm with the hazard ratio? I thought Altitude was like nothing, and then all of a sudden
it turned out to be negative,
very big with the win odds. So
yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting, guys. I mean, one of the and we haven't even gotten to this yet, but one of the benefits of the hierarchical composite analyzed with win odds is that we really do tend to increase the power because we learn as much as we can from every participant, and we have so many comparisons, and it does increase the power. And what we saw with Altitude, and I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but was the for the original primary endpoint, the hazard ratio crossed one, and so, you know, there was maybe not statistically, you know, for people who like to use the T word of trend, maybe somebody who said, oh, there's a trend for, you know, more outcomes on the active treatment. And you know, like this was a post-hoc analysis. We can't make any conclusions, but you know, certainly the win odds was less than one for the treatment group when we analyzed Altitude, and the confidence interval was all less than zero. So, you know, it's a demonstration of the increased power that we had. And you're absolutely right, Brendan. We didn't want to only analyze positive trials. If we have an endpoint and it performs well, we want to see it performing well, you know, kind of across the spectrum. And so we were, you know, happy to see that consistency even for the not positive trial of Altitude.
Absolutely.
So can I?
I think that increase in power is a very important thing, right? Also for future trial size. I think all of those trials, they require, I think the sample sizes were enormous. You can't do like so many trials with so many IDs every time you need 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 patients. The power analysis we did, for example, in DAPA CKD, and I'm going to be a bit short in the corners, but you can easily see like a 90% improvement in sample size. So either you need 4,000 patients, you now need around 400 patients. But of course, there were also some people saying, well, you know, then because slope is the biggest contributor, right, to this endpoint. And if you do like a trial of 400 patients, you will see very little events in those patients. So the question is, of course, what is maybe the improvement in power when you have a significant effect on all those components individually? That would be a very interesting question still to see. But I'm convinced that it will lead to improvements in power. That's for sure.
I think that's really, really important as we're thinking about drug development. And again, especially my bias is the rare kidney disease space where it's just not feasible to do a 10-year trial, especially placebo-controlled in patients with these rare kidney diseases. And the numbers are small to begin with really stringent inclusion-exclusion criteria. But I guess one of the things I wanted to touch on at some point, but I'm going to ask it now, is, you know, with having an HCE, one of the things that comes up is like the fixed follow-up. And I was wondering if one of you could speak on that. And also as a corollary, how would you use that in a study like FLOW, where the study's terminated early because of efficacy? How then would you, let's say you had, you know, this is how you would design the study, and the study ends up being stopped early by the DSMB, what do you do then?
So this is a difficult story. And for now, I think the theoretical assumption is that we need fixed follow-up. But you're entirely right. And I would agree so. But you can also think from a practical point of view, and we also evaluated this, that it's not really necessary, but it depends on the situation. Also, the DAPA-CKD trial was stopped early, and we included that in one of those in the analysis we did for the publication we wrote. And one of the reviewers told us, like, you have to account for the different follow-ups in each pairwise comparisons, right? Because sometimes you have a patient that only participated 100 days, and you compare it against a patient that participated the entire study for, let's say, 3 years. Then the comparison is not fair, because it is much more likely that you will see an event in that patient that contributed most of the time. So we did all the comparison on the minimum follow-up time. So either comparing 100 days with 3 years, we did the comparison on that 100 days, and we did that for every pairwise comparison. The estimates were basically the same. And I think that has to do with that the follow-up times are randomly distributed over both treatment arms. And as long as that is the case, and that is something we can test, I think that the fixed follow-up is maybe not such a big deal. But from a theoretical point of view, I think the statisticians are completely right. And we still have to show that my idea is actually, or my hypothesis is correct. But that's what my gut feeling is saying. So we still have to really look into that.
Okay, that's important to know and interesting. And Dustin, let's say you're speaking to a skeptic who says, you know, you guys are just trying to reduce sample sizes and trial duration. And you know, I'm skeptical of the hierarchical composite endpoint. What are some of the limitations that someone like that might bring up? And this is not a completely new concept. This has been applied to cardiology in cardiology trials. Am I correct in saying? And there have been therapeutics that have been approved based on hierarchical composite endpoints in other disease states. So what are some of the limitations in general? And can you give an example of how that limitation is relevant in a kidney disease trial?
Yeah, definitely. There, you know, Brendan, there were a few parts of your question for us to tackle. But one of the, you're right. I mean, one of the limitations people will bring up is they'll say, who decides how these events are prioritized, right? And you know, one of the things that's really nice about HCEs is they are flexible. And you know, we've talked about, we should probably bring patients into the room and think about, you know, how we should prioritize events. But one of the great things about the HCE as we have developed it so far is we built it all out of components that we can use to get drugs approved now, either hard endpoints or, like you said, Sheikha, validated surrogate endpoints. And the prioritization with the events we have, you know, we think is actually pretty straightforward, you know, death and then varying severity of, you know, GFR declines and GFR slope at the end. So that's one of the things that people will criticize. To be honest, I think that's more of a criticism for a cardiovascular trial where you have to say, is it worse to have a, you know, a stroke on day 10 or a myocardial infarction that's really severe on day 180, you know, but for us, you know, it's probably always better to have a 40% GFR decline than a 50% GFR decline. And it's probably always better to have lost this amount of kidney function over time than that amount of kidney function over time. So that's one of the criticisms, you know. And then another one, Brendan, is how do we interpret this win odds? And I guess this gets back to what I was bringing up before. I think if we like erased... You guys remember the movie Men in Black, where they would erase people's memories? I think it's like Will Smith. If he erased all of our memories and we had to start from scratch, I'm not sure we would say, oh, it's so easy to understand hazard ratio, but I digress. So it's how do we interpret this win odds? That's one of the things. And to be honest, we've got some more work to do there. But I want to try an analogy, and it came from Barbara Gillespie at a recent meeting, you know, who I know we all know and really love. And so it's the Chiefs and the Bills, okay? They play each other 25 times, right? The Chiefs, and apologize if there's any Bills fans, the Chiefs win 15 times, the Bills win 10 times, right? So first of all, I know I'd rather be a fan of the Chiefs or play on the Chiefs, everything else being equal. And the win odds, we can directly calculate that. It's 15 over 10, I think it's what I used before, so it's 1.5. And one more thing, we have the bones to calculate a number needed to treat. You know, somebody in the back of the room is always going to say, yeah, that's great, but what's the number needed to treat? Yeah, your hazard ratio of 0.7 is great, but what's the N and T? And in this scenario, right, the Bills and Chiefs played each other five times, and every five times they played, there was an extra win for the Chiefs. So we have a number needed to treat of five. So, you know, so we have some work to do, like I said, but we actually, I think, have like the building blocks of something that if we step back and think about it, you know, we can learn how to interpret it. So those are a couple of limitations. And then there's a couple of other technical ones that we're exploring as well. Like, does it really make sense if one person has a GFR slope of, you know, -3 and the other person has a GFR slope of -2.9? Does it really make sense to say we can determine a win or a loss from that? And Niels has done some really good work, and you know, we think it'll be published pretty soon, where we've said, oh, there has to be a certain difference in the slope to declare a win. And at the end of the day, it looks like that doesn't make much of a difference. The results aren't so sensitive to that. So so some limitations, but I've got some things we can talk to the skeptics about. And hey, Brendan, while I'm rambling, I want to say one more thing, and I want to talk about increased power. So Shika, sometimes, like you said, it's just not only is it not feasible, I don't think it's possible to do an outcomes trial in you know, something like a FSGS, or, you know, but do we give up? Do we stop there? I mean, of course not. We, you know, we have a big unmet need. And other times it might be that we can put together enough participants to do an outcomes trial, but if we have a really effective drug and we can learn that sooner, and we can get that drug to patients who need it sooner, you know, I'd rather be doing that in 3 years than 10 years. And so I think sometimes when people hear us talk about power, they might assume, we just want to get something on the market as soon as we can and start. You know, when I work for a pharmaceutical company and start, you know, making money for the company. But at least for me, that's not really what it's about. It's about demonstrating a clinically relevant benefit and not waiting forever to get something to the people who really need it.
I think this was really awesome. And thank you for sort of breaking that down, Dustin. While you're on the topic, I guess one of the things I wanted to ask either you or Niels, when we're talking about these HCEs, and I'm a big proponent of the patient voice and PROs, just through work with, you know, Parasol, Prepare and S, is there a certain number of, you know, variables or factors that we can include within the HCE to still have it be effective? And can we incorporate things that are important to patients, such as relapse-free survival or resolution of edema in patients with nephrotic syndrome, for example? Obviously, the question of prioritization then gets a little bit murky. I think most patients would agree, obviously, that death should still be first or all-cause mortality, and then need for renal replacement therapy. These would probably be lower, but is there a certain number after which, you know, we're starting to, it's just too much from a statistical standpoint? I know there was 7, you know, variables used in the example that you guys published, but I was just curious.
Well, from a statistical point of view, it's not an issue at all. You only have to think of when you add multiple continuous component that you will never end up at your second continuous component, because everything will be every comparison will be finalized at your first continuous component. So it depends a bit on how your continuous component is set up, but most of the time that will be the case. But I think the nice thing about the kidney AC we introduce is that it follows this causal pathway. So you don't want to interrupt it, right? So that's what you said. Well, death is maybe the only weird thing in this collection of endpoints. But then first dialysis, renal replacement therapy, then your eGFR decline endpoints. That makes a lot of sense from a progression point of view. Adding something in between would only disturb that order. And then you will end up with the discussion, which one is more important? There are some ways to tackle it, I think. But this is a typical issue you see in cardiology. And today I read some papers also in acute kidney injury that they recently published a paper where they also applied our composite endpoint. And they had, for example, intensive care stay as a continuous endpoint and hospitalization stay. And I wasn't sure if shorter stay or longer stay was better. So I think this already illustrates the issue you can have with these kind of things, right? So,
yeah, I mean, Niels, I definitely think we wanted to start with the most straightforward. I mean, I think some of the discussions, you know, it's not necessarily straightforward to everybody. It's a new methodology. It's a new way of looking at things. And so we wanted to start with let's build this out of what we use in clinical trials already. I said it before, either clinical endpoints or validated surrogate endpoints. B, they're all, like Neil said, except for mortality, they're all part of the same, you know, sort of spectrum. Clinical goal I have, slowing CKD progression, reducing the risk of kidney failure. C, they're all interrelated, which is really nice statistically. D, the prioritization is straightforward. But Chika, I think, you know, in the future, we could, and Niels brings up some statistical challenges there, interpretation challenges, but I definitely think we could. I mean, if we were talking about polycystic kidney disease at a recent meeting, and we know that individuals with polycystic kidney disease can experience a lot of pain related to their polycystic kidneys, and it would make sense to think about an HCE that factors in pain somewhere along the spectrum, and maybe even, you know, change in kidney size, because there's some data on that as a surrogate endpoint. So I think we have to be thoughtful about it, but I think when it makes sense, I think, you know, it's something we can do. And Niels told us it's not a problem statistically, so we're going to hold him to it. But I just think, you know, like anything else, right, Chika, we have to make sure that at the end of the day, we can interpret, we have a composite endpoint, and we can look at each of the components and kind of make sense of it and make sure they contributed and all that. So I think some of this is new, but some of the old rules about composite endpoints still apply. So I definitely think, you know, in your glomerular disease patients with nephrotic syndrome, and we're trying to induce a relapse, or we're trying to reduce the, you know, the edema and the other complications, and maybe even the risk of thrombosis, and we're talking about membranous nephropathy, I think this is a tool we have where we potentially can, combine some of those different paradigms. So I think this is something for us to think about in the future for sure.
Right. I think even for CKD, right, we have still this open standing issue that is incorporating cardiovascular events. You know, and we worked on it, and it's a bit like on a hold right now, but we really have to continue this. But then, you know, adding cardiovascular events, it disturbs the order, right? So, yes, I think that is one of the things for CKD that's still important to tackle. But yeah, maybe with that question, you can also develop totally new endpoints.
And you bring up a really good point, Dustin, with your polycystic kidney disease example. One of the, I think, real attractions from my point of view with a hierarchical composite endpoint is we can incorporate both clinical endpoints but also patient-reported outcomes, right? Mm-hmm. So we're not just talking about laboratory measures and clinical measures, but we can potentially incorporate quality of life measures or cyst pain in your example. And I think that is really attractive to both patients and clinicians, and something which we haven't typically done with a traditional composite endpoint, but which we can do with a hierarchical composite endpoint.
Yeah, we absolutely can, Brendan. And just to say it again, when, you know, we do that, and it might become a little bit, how do we arrange the hierarchy? But the thing about it is we can only have the complication of how to arrange the hierarchy because we can prioritize the events, right? So we're in the ballpark, right? I mean, we would other trial designs, you know, the prioritization is just imposed upon us, right? So we at least it brings some complexity, but it also brings some opportunity as well.
I mean, I think what you guys are saying makes so much sense. Like, let's start in the CKD space, which with hard endpoints that we know that have been used previously, and let's start doing, you know, some large trials, or not as large as we needed before, because we don't need to make them as large as we maybe needed to make them before, and see how we move forward, and then think of creative ways to incorporate, you know, an HCE specific to a particular disease, right? So when I think about, let's say, lupus nephritis, I want to decrease relapses. I want to get patients off steroids. I want to prevent infections, which is a very different. Of course, I also want to prevent all the hard outcomes as well, or the hard, you know, but at the same time, these are things that we're dealing with in some of these relapse remitting diseases that are unique to that particular subset of patients. Then let's say, you know, that are on immunosuppression, multiple immunosuppressants these days, compared to a, you know, diabetic kidney disease patient, for example. So, no, I think this was really helpful to sort of think through. One of the questions I also had for you all was, how do we think about subgroup analyses when we are using an HCE? Is it the same way? Is it, you know, already incorporated in some senses? Are there any special things we need to do when we're, you know, looking at subgroups if we have an HCE?
You know, my first reaction on that, Shika, is that it's I think it's about the same as any other trial. I mean, I think, you know, we're going to do a trial and we're going to power it for the overall group, right? But then we're going to need to look at you know, individual subgroups and see if there's any, you know, sign of inconsistency. And you know, I think the rules are really about the same there, in my opinion. Niels, would you see it that way too?
Well, I think, you know, I get what you're saying, right? But nowadays, we have all these big trials and they've been powered the way you've just described, like for the overall population. And then we always do the subgroup analysis, but they're never powered for the subgroup analysis.
Yeah.
So the conclusion is always that the treatment effect is the same, right? That's basically what you read all the time. But you can imagine that when you have increased power, for example, and you would redo all those analyses, you might find some other results, right? That because you simply have some more power. But now if you start to design trials using the orthocomposite endpoints, and you power them for the overall population, again, you have too little power for the subgroups, right? So, yeah, it's nice to see a trend, but again, you don't have any hard evidence for your subgroups.
So am I hearing that you're saying we could power them for subgroups if we used HCE? Is that too big of a stretch?
Of course you could, but, you know, it becomes a bigger trial. So that's always an... a choice that those that design the trials have to make. I think that's also an issue of financial means, but that's a completely different topic.
You know, Niels, you quoted earlier, you know, when we look back at DAPA-CKD and the number of participants we would need to have, you know, 90% power based on the HCE, and the number is pretty low. You know, if we were trying to get a drug approved, we wouldn't do that small of a trial, right? We need to make sure we have an adequate safety database. You know, we need to make sure that we can say something about the components of our composite. So I think there might be something there, right? You know, just because we need X hundred patients to have 90% power for whatever doesn't mean that would be the trial size.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so any sort of efficiency we can gain to help us better understand the data could certainly apply to subgroups. So that, yeah, I hadn't thought about it that way, but that's a good point, Shika and Niels.
So just building on this conversation about rare diseases, finally, I just wanted to talk about FSGS, because I know, Niels, you've done an analysis recently of DAPA-CKD. It's yet to be published, but has been presented in a short example form, where in DAPA-CKD, there was a small amount of patients with FSGS, 100 or 200 patients or so. And there was some suggestion of that the numerical incidence of kidney failure and 50% declines were less with dapagliflozin. Slope was slightly better, but overall no clear effect because of the wide confidence intervals by virtue of the small population. We're talking about increases in statistical power. Can you use that cohort, the FSGS cohort in DAPA-CKD, as an example of the win odds and the hierarchical composite endpoint? And tell us what you found.
So yeah, we still have to publish those results. And I've done many of those analyses, and I'm not sure what the results were exactly. I think they were slightly above, like, let's call it borderline significant or borderline non-significant in both those directions. But I think what is more important, instead of looking at the treatment estimates, is do the same thing for those subgroups, and then the power analysis and do the same thing for those subgroups, and then see how many patients would we need to show to have sufficient power, because only showing a treatment effect doesn't tell you if you had enough power, yes or no. And I think that is the biggest question for designing those trials. How many power do you, how many patients do you need to obtain sufficient power? Results, I think, were much better than with the HCE, if I remember correctly. But again, we still have to publish those results. But again, I'm not sure what the power was at that point. So
yeah, I mean,
still we have to figure out.
Niels, it's going to be great to get those results out to the world. So I hope you and Hitto and the crew are hard at it. But
Hitto was writing this weekend.
So what I remember, Brendan, from seeing it was if you look at just the events, there's numerically fewer events in the treatment group, and the confidence interval is numerically less than one, the point estimate is less than one, but the confidence interval crosses one, and then you look at slope, and it's kind of the same thing numerically in favor of the treatment group, but the confidence interval crosses one, and it on Niels's analysis, if I'm remembering correctly, we did see tighter confidence interval with the HCE and the win odds, and everything greater than one, so everything on the other side of unity. And I think it's a good, this is post hoc, of course, but I think it's a good example of, I mean, sometimes even with slope, which what a gift it is, it can be difficult to even power a trial for slope in a certain subgroup. And the HCE isn't the only game in town. I mean, you guys had a podcast on Parasol and the really great progress there, and we got to think about other endpoints. But there are definitely situations where that making the most out of every trial participant, really maximizing the learnings and the power and the efficiency, can really help us. And sometimes it might get us over a threshold where we're able to feel a little more confident in the results of our trial.
Well, thank you so much, Dustin and Niels, for joining us. Shika, great to see you as always. It's been a real pleasure talking about hierarchical composite endpoints in nephrology. There's been, as some listeners will know, the National Kidney Foundation sponsored workshop on HCEs last week. So we look forward to seeing the output from that workshop and the conclusions. And of course, as Chico mentioned, the great articles that were published in JASN at the end of 2024 or 2023, maybe, perhaps now.
And more to follow, right, Brendan? Sorry for...
yeah. So thank you very much, guys, and really appreciate having you join the podcast today. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you for joining us on this episode of Kidney Compass. We hope you've enjoyed this episode as much as we've enjoyed talking about hierarchical composite endpoints. And be sure to subscribe so you don't miss out on upcoming episodes. And if you have any topics you'd like us to cover, as always, please reach out to us. See you next time.